Hi, everybody. My name is Shirley Timpson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm here for rebuttal. My sobriety date is July the 29th, 1982. That is the number one thing in my life today. And on July the 29th, 1982, that's what I wanted to do, was get sober. Well, you met my driver. He drove me to drinking. Well, he did. He drove me to treatment, and he drove me to Macon, Georgia this weekend. My husband, Bo. You know, Bill wrote As Bill Sees It. Lois wrote Lois Remembers. And Shirley's going to tell you her side of it this morning. The big book says, I share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I would much rather stand up here and tell you what it's like today. Because when I got here, I was a piece of junk. And I'm not that today. I'm a lady. I'm an AA lady. I'm the oldest of three children. I have a brother that's 4 years younger than I am, and he's normal. We don't know what that means. David doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't cuss. He's lived in the same house forever and had the same job. And what he does for fun, we don't know. And then there's my sister Gail, and she's 8 years younger than I am, and she's somewhere right now in Florida working on her story. And when I was 13 years old, my parents divorced, and we thought we got the problem out of the house. My mom came to me and David and Gail and said, pack up all your stuff. We're moving in with your grandparents, and it tickled me to death. I was the oldest grandchild, and I was spoiled rotten, and I was proud of it. We moved in with my grandmother and granddaddy, and I knew I would be okay. This was in the summer. I turned 14 that year, and in September, I started to high school. And I was going to be okay. You see, this granny took time to spend with me, and she taught me things that I still remember today. My grandmother made all my clothes for me. I can remember sitting by the fire at night and hemming a blouse or hemming a dress or a jumper or something that I could wear to school the next day. I always had on something new. And you know what I remember? I remember sitting at the lunch table wondering when could I have something that was bought? Why did I always have to have homemade clothes? Boy, what I wouldn't love to have something homemade right now. But I remember sitting at the lunch tables and thinking, you know, I'm going to be okay now. I live with my grandparents and they're going to take care of me. I remember my first Christmas. It was the best Christmas I ever had. My grandmother kept coming out of bedrooms with presents for me and Dave and Gail, and we just couldn't believe it because there were a number of Christmases that we didn't have anything. Really didn't have anything. Because, you see, my dad was the kind of person who would start drinking and he might make it home with a little bit of money and he might not. And he might make it home and he might not. And my daddy was a violent person when he drank. And His weapon was the belt buckle end of the belt, which he used quite often on me. Right after Christmas this particular year, my grandmother, I remember vividly my grandmother being taken from the home in an ambulance to the hospital. And I was told it wasn't anything serious, that Granny would be back shortly, and Granny never came back. She died at the end of January of cancer at the age of 50. And I thought, this is not going to work. You know, what in the world am I going to do without my granny? I knew why my daddy was no longer around, but I had no idea what I would do without my grandmother. And shortly after this, my granddaddy sat my mom down at the kitchen table, and he said, Louise, honey, if you're going to live here in this house with your three children, you need to get a job. If my grandmother hadn't died, we'd still be at my grandmother's, I guess. And my mother's answer to that was, Dad, if I've got to get a job, we'll move out. And we did, all the way across town. Don't understand that. We got a little two-bedroom apartment, and my mother went to work for the first time in her life. She found a job working from 3 in the afternoon until 11. And so David and Gail and I were going to school, and we were coming home to a house that was empty. My mother was working. And when she came in from work every night, we were in bed asleep. When we got up the next morning to go to school, she was in bed asleep. So I took over the role of being mother. I was on that 305 bus every afternoon from school to get home so that I could take care of David and Gail. And I don't think I ever had a problem with that. I knew that my mother needed me to take care of that. And I made sure that they got their homework and they had something to eat for dinner and that we washed blue jeans and it was okay. Dating was not ever an issue. I know I sat at the lunch table with the girlfriends of mine and we talked about you good-looking hunks. And yes, there was such a word as hunk back then. But I'd never been out on a date. And it really wasn't a problem to me. I had my hands full going to school and getting home and taking care of Dave and Gail. One particular day, a girlfriend of mine said, "Shirley, I'm going out on a blind date this coming Saturday. Do you think your mother would let you go out on a double date?" And I said, "Well, I'll ask her. She doesn't work on Saturday. Maybe I can go." And so I remember going to my mom and asking her if I could go out on this blind date. And then her remark was, "Shirley, honey, nothing ever happens on a blind date." Those of you who were here yesterday heard my blind date. Tell me nothing ever happens on a blind date. And I remember meeting Bo, and my mother had already told me when he walks you to the door, "Shirley, don't kiss him goodnight." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Good girls don't do that." So Bo and I went roller skating. We had a ball. And sometime during that afternoon, that night, he asked me for my telephone number. And I was so grateful that he asked me for my phone number because, you see, I was not going to be able to kiss him goodnight when he walked me to the door. And sure enough, we get to the door, and my curfew is 10 o'clock. You know, I don't understand why anybody could get in trouble back then, because your curfew was such that you had to get home. And my curfew was 10, and you just didn't have time for a lot of stuff. You know, you just didn't have time. And he walked me to the door that night, and he tried to kiss me, and I remembered what my mom said, so I didn't kiss him. And he left. I remember seeing him get in his car and leave, and I thought, I'll never hear from him again. And what was going through my mind was, I had fallen in love with him that night. And I've been in love with him ever since. This past April 30th, we celebrated 37 years of marriage. But I fell in love with him that night. And I don't understand. It just happened. I don't know whether it was pretty blue eyes or his smile or his personality. I don't know. But when he walked me to the door, I wanted to kiss him goodnight. But my mother said I couldn't. And so I walked in and she was ironing. And she said, "Well, how did it go, Shirley?" And I said, "I'm going to marry him one of these days." And she said, "Did you kiss him goodnight?" And I said, "No, ma'am." And she said, "Well, he probably won't call you back anyway." My mother was always the one who said, "Go for it, girl. You know, go for your dreams." And I didn't get a lot of encouragement from my mom. I remember laying awake that night thinking, "Is he going to call me, or what will I do if he doesn't call me?" And that Sunday afternoon after he came in from church and had lunch, he called me and asked me for a date for Sunday night. And I ran and asked my mom if I could have another date, and she said, "Well, your curfew's 10 o'clock. So Bo picked me up, and I remember him opening the car door for me. You remember, girls, when they used to open the car door for you? And he opened the car door, and I slid across the front seat. This was before bucket seats. And I slid across to the middle, and he went around and got in on his side, and he closed the door, and he put his arms around me, and he kissed me. And bless his heart, he's been kissing me ever since. And we dated for 5 years, and during this 5 years, we talked an awful lot about getting married. And, you know, I don't know, maybe he fell in love with me that night, too. But we started talking about getting married, and we were both in high school. We knew we had to wait until after we got out of high school. And he was from a divorced family, and I'm from a divorced family. And he had one parent less and I had one parent missing, and we just didn't want to get married and have children and have them go through what we went through. So we made a vow at the state fair on the bleachers one Friday night that come heck or high waters, we were going to make this thing work. Bless his heart, he just didn't know the heck and high waters that he was going to have to go through with his little alcoholic. And I remember when Bo put the ring on my finger, the first thing I thought of was, I've got to call my dad. Where that came from, I don't know. I just imagined that in order to make this marriage work, I needed to walk down that aisle on the arm of my dad. So what I did was, one night I picked up the Birmingham telephone directory and I looked up my dad's name, and there it was, and I called him. And I made my first mistake by calling at night. My dad picked up the telephone and he still had that slur that I remember the last time. And I told him who I was, and I told him that I was getting married on April the 30th and would he come and give me away. And he said, why, sure I will. You know, just like he always said. And he said, tell me what time, where the church is, and what do I wear, and surely I'll be there. And the hair on my arm stood up, because once more, that was a promise that my daddy had made to me. But I believed him this time. See, this was different. I'm getting married. That's going to be different. And so we get to the church that night in Ueytown, and everyone is seated, and the organ music is playing, and all the candles are lit, and it's time for this wedding. And Bo and his father and the preacher are down front in that little room off to the side waiting to come out. And I'm standing at the back with my mom waiting to walk down that aisle. And there's no daddy. And it's going through my mind, he's not going to show up one more time. And about that time, a couple of guys walked outside to smoke a cigarette, and I heard one of the guys say, well, come on, buddy, pull up on the sidewalk. It's okay with me. And I said, he's here. Hey, I don't care where you park. Just get in here. And that was my dad, pulled right up on the sidewalk in front of that church. And he got out of the car, and he walked through those big double doors, and he came over, and he looked at me, and he looked at my mom, and you could tell he'd been drinking. He had that natural glow one more time. And he turned around and walked out. Walked right back out those big double doors and got in his car and left. And I'm thinking, he can't do this to me. He promised this time. And you see, what I think I had in the back of my mind was, if my daddy would show up this one time and walk me down the aisle, it would take away all those times that he promised he would come home that he didn't. It would take away all the times that he beat me with a belt buckle into the belt. If he would just show up and walk me down the aisle, that would tell me that he really did love me. And he left. And my brother David, standing over there, and he said, oh, come on and pull that veil down over your face. I'll walk you down the aisle. I've been trying to get rid of you for years. And to this day, David thinks he's the reason Bo and I have stayed together, and we just let him believe it. It's just not worth arguing. And so Bo and I left that night on our honeymoon, and I remember as soon as we got in the car, I said, there won't be any drinking in our home. And I think Bo said, yes, ma'am, I'm not sure, but I made the statement that there wouldn't be any drinking in our home. And we pulled away from that church that night, and we started on something that we call the Great American Dream. We didn't know a clue about life. We had no idea what life was all about, but we knew we loved each other, and we knew we'd be okay. You know, I have to tell you right now that all throughout all of the active alcoholism, throughout all the bad stuff, the love between me and Bo has never, ever flickered. It's just like a gas stove. We didn't have the eyes on, but we had that little tiny pilot light that never went out. And we didn't have a lot of things going on in our home when this disease was in full force, but that little pilot light never went out. And when we got to this program, and we got to AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, we were able to put this family back together. And I'd like to tell you that today, in West Blockton, Alabama, all four of those eyes are wide open. And I couldn't love him any more today than I do right now. Well, we left this church and we thought, well, we both got good jobs and let's save up for a down payment on a little house because we both wanted children. We wanted one boy, we wanted one girl, and we wanted a big backyard. And so we saved up that first year, and we had enough money for the down payment on that little three-bedroom, one-bath house out in this little part of Hueytown. And it had a little bitty front yard with two driveways and a great big backyard with a chain-link fence. And we moved in, and we celebrated our first anniversary and no kids. We celebrated our second wedding anniversary and no kids, but we were trying. Honestly, we were trying. And on our third wedding anniversary, Bo pulled in the driveway that afternoon with me, a little two-door red Thunderbird. Prettiest little car on the road, candy apple red. And it did have bucket seats. And it did have a tilt steering wheel that you pushed out of the way to sit down in that pretty little bucket seat. And it didn't hold any groceries, but that was the prettiest little car on the road. And I'd get up at 5:30 every morning just to go to work. I loved it. And one day on the way home from work, a man pulled over in my lane. I was in his blind spot, and he scraped me all the way down the left side. No problem, no damage, really, just a scrape. And I had to point it out to Bo when I got home. And his remark was, "You need to go to the doctor." And I said, "But I'm not hurt." He said, "I know, but it's his fault. Go to the doctor and get a checkup. Be just fine." So I went to the doctor. And that's back then, yes, back then they didn't make appointments. You just go and you sit and you wait. And what I did was I went and I sat and I waited. And finally around lunchtime they called me in and the doctor checked me over from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And he looked at me and he said, "Shirley, go in my office, honey. Just as soon as I get through with this test, I'll be right in." And I thought, why does he want to talk to me? I'm fine. In fact, I feel better than I have in months. And so I went on in his office and sat down in front of his desk. And I sat there and I waited thinking, what in the world could be wrong with me? And he walked in and instead of going over and sitting across from me and facing me, he just pulled up the chair right next to me. And he tapped me on the knee and he said, "Shirley, you're 2 months pregnant." I said, "From the red?" And I thought, you know, I can't tell Bo. This is crazy. I mean, I hadn't even had a drink by this time, you know. So the doctor says, "Well, why don't you just get Bo on the phone and I'll tell him." And so we call Bo up, and as soon as I get his voice on the phone, I just hand the phone to the doctor, and he says, "Bo, I have Shirley. We've checked her out, and she's 2 months pregnant." Bo said, "From the wreck?" Well, that little wreck's name was Mike. He was born November the 10th of that year, the sunshine of my life. And the only word to describe Mike is hunk. There's no other word. Then I had another wreck, and her name is Sissy. And she's brown-headed and brown-eyed. And I'd like to tell every mother in this room that my prayer for you this morning would be that you have half of the relationship with your daughter that I have with mine, and you will be okay. Just half of the relationship that Cece and I have today, my prayer would be for you to have half of that, and you'll be okay. You'll never ask for another thing. So we took an inventory. We had a little boy. We had a little girl. That's all the variety they had, so we didn't have any more. And we did take an inventory, deciding that in order, because I had Mike and turned right around and had Sissy 17 months later, so I didn't go back to work until Sissy was 6 months old. And we had to do this in order to continue living the Great America dream. And what I promised Bo was that I would find a babysitter who would take care of these children in my absence. And I searched and I found the lady. I found a lady who was far more than a babysitter. This lady was available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mama Betty taught my children things that I still see today in Sissy. Mama Betty would call me at work and say, "It's pouring down rain, it's going to get worse, leave the children here with me and I'll get them to school tomorrow morning." She would tell me on Friday morning when I would drop them off at her house, why don't you and Bo pack a little overnight bag and go off for the night? You need to get away. Mama Betty was in place in our lives when the disease of alcoholism reared its ugly head. You know, I can even remember when Mike and Sissy would get sick, they would cry for Mama Betty. And I used to think, they don't love me. But it was because Mama Betty just took them and just adopted them as her very own. I went back to work, and one day at lunch, a girl asked me if I'd like to be a member of a sorority that she was in. And you know, I didn't get to do stuff like that in high school because I had to be on that 305 bus and go straight home. And I thought, man, this is great. I can now be a member of a club. I've never been a member of a club. And so I joined. I went through the initiation, and in late August, they had a party down at one of the ladies' lake houses on the Warrior River right outside of Hueytown. And once more, Mama Betty had the children for the whole weekend, and we didn't have to be in any hurry to get back home. And so we drive down to the Warrior River, and this lady's got candles all out in her yard, and she has a live band, and the moon's reflecting off of that water, and there's a gentle breeze and an open bar. And sometime that afternoon, early evening, my husband walked up to me with a drink, and he said, here, honey, drink this. And being the good wife that I am, I drank it. And I'm an alcoholic who remembers her last drink, and I certainly remember my first. And it looked like this. It was in a real tall glass with just a shade of pink to it. It had a toothpick across the top, and on that toothpick it had a maraschino cherry with a stem, a slice of orange, and a hunk of pineapple. And somewhere in that glass was an umbrella. I know there was an umbrella because I drank it all. And I just started tingling all over. I loved it. It was a Tom Collins. I loved it. I think I had another one that night. And I felt my toes tingle, and I felt my fingers. Oh, I just felt my fingernails growing. And it was beautiful. I loved it. And I'd go to these meetings once a month, and I'd come home, and Bo would say, well, how was your meeting? And I would say, well, it was great. Well, what did you do? I said, well, we opened the meeting with a drink. And then we conducted a little bit of business, and we had a drink. And then we closed the meeting, and we had a drink. And he said, is that all you did? I said, I think so. And I remember him saying, I don't think you need to be in a club like that. And you know what it did? I resigned. It was no problem. But let me tell you what it did. I started having something there at the house, and I liked it. For years, I thought alcohol was a stimulant. It just really broke my heart when I found out it was a depressant, because it didn't work that way on me. And let me tell you something else. I'm an alcoholic who didn't run around. I didn't go to bars. I didn't drink and drive. I've never been in jail. I've never had a DUI. I did all my drinking in my kitchen on 28th Avenue in Hueytown from 4:35 in the afternoon until I passed out. But let me tell you, I did just as much damage and I did just as much harm as any woman who's ever been to every bar and done all the things that a lot of women have done. I just did all my damage at home. And let me tell you the damage that I did. Boy, I did some damage. First of all, I drink wine. I'm a wineette. All of you guys who drink wine are winos, and that just doesn't suit me. I am a wineette. And I want to tell you what I drank. I drank Boone's Farm Tickle Pink. Hey, it did the trick. It was only $3.17. I could buy it on my grocery bill, and I could slide those bottles in my crisper in the refrigerator, and Bo never knew. I would come in from work, and I would pour me a glass of Tickle Pink. And what I did was I kept it in a real pretty wine decanter in the refrigerator. Clear glass. Beautiful. My children love strawberry Kool-Aid, and I kept it for them on the other side of the refrigerator in a white Tupperware pitcher. And I was real quick to tell Mike and Sissy, Mom's Kool-Aid is on the left, your Kool-Aid's on the right. And Sissy is 32 years old today, with two children, and those children never get Kool-Aid. They'll never get Kool-Aid. And that's the smallest scar that my drinking put on my little girl. I would start drinking, and when I'd get in from work at 4:30, at 4:35, I had a drink in my hand, and sometimes I lasted to finishing dinner, and sometimes I didn't. My daughter is the best cook in the world today, and she can clean up her house better than I can clean up mine. And it was because when I would pass out, she would have to pull a chair up to the stove and finish dinner. Sissy's left-handed. And when I would pass out early in the evening, I would wake up again sometime in the middle of the night to go get me another drink. And I would walk in the kitchen and everything would be spotless. Everything cleaned up. Not anything out of place. And I would open up the dishwasher, and Sissy had loaded the dishwasher. And you know what I would do? I would go wake her up and tell her, if you can't load the dishwasher the way I want it loaded, don't do it. Because she was left-handed. And then I would look in the dryer to see if she had folded those towels that I had left, and she had. And I would walk right back straight to the linen closet, and I would pull every one of those towels out of that linen closet and go wake her up and tell her, if you can't fold them the way I wanted them folded, Sissy, don't do it. Let me tell you what I did to my kids. I took away their laughter. I took away their laughter. I took away their self-respect. I took away their personality, any goals that they had. I took away their self-respect. I told my daughter that if she made better grades, I wouldn't drink. She made the honor roll. I told them everything. I would tell Mike that if he would stay home in the afternoons instead of getting on his motorcycle, that I wouldn't drink. He never stayed at home in the afternoons because he knew his mother could not keep from drinking. I remember when Bo came in from work one afternoon with this motorcycle in the back of a pickup truck, and what went through my mind was that I've got one more thing to worry about. One more thing to worry about, a motorcycle. And I want to tell you that every time he pulled out of that driveway to go riding on it, my prayer would be, God, please don't let a drunk driver hit mine. Because, you see, by the time he came home at 10 o'clock at night, I was already passed out, either in bed or in the floor. And I never knew whether he got home on time or not. He always did, but I never knew it. I remember getting up one morning and going to the kitchen and once more finding everything in place. And I thought, well, they just don't need me anymore. You know, they just don't need me anymore. I walked back to the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I said, you know, God, I do not remember the last time Bo looked at me and said, I love you so much. I said, you know, God, I can't remember the last time Mike looked at me and put his arms around me and said, Mom, you smell so good. And you know, God, I can't remember the last time Sissy gave me a compliment for something I did for her. And looking through to that mirror with these bloodshot eyes that were now red, and the natural glow that my daddy gave to me, this voice came back and it said, hey, Shirley, when was the last time you put your arms around Bo and told him you loved him? Hey, Shirley, when was the last time you put your arms around Mike and told him he smelled good? And Shirley, how about the last time you gave Sissy a compliment for something that she did? I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Call me anything in the world, but please don't call me an alcoholic. And I never laid a hand on my kids. And I only drank in my kitchen on 28th Avenue. But I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to live anymore. I was 38 years old, and I had nothing in this world to live for anymore. My family members were going to a ball game in July of 82, and one more time they didn't ask me to go, and one more time I didn't want to go. And Sissy and Bo were already in the car ready to leave. And Mike had forgotten his hairbrush that he always carried on his left hip pocket, blue jean pocket. And so he headed for the front door and realized he didn't have his hairbrush. So back to his bedroom he goes. And just as he gets to the front door, now Mike is 15 years old and he's about a half of a head taller than me, blonde-headed, blue-eyed, good-looking. And he stops at the front door and he looks at me and he said, hey, Mom, when we get home tonight from the ball game, will you be passed out in bed? are passed out on the floor. And this hand got right here to slap his teeth out. How dare my son stand there and make a remark like that to me? And just as my hand got right here, I remember the last time my daddy beat me with a belt buckle into that belt. And I hollered at my dad and I said, "Dad, if I ever, ever have children, if God ever allows me to have children, I swear I'll never lay a hand on them." And at this point in my life, I was just about to slap Mike's teeth out. And you know what's scary? I was already drinking and I could have really hurt him bad. Mike didn't wait for an answer, and I didn't have to slap him. He went and got in the car with his dad and sister, and they went to the ball game. And you know what I did? I went and poured myself another drink. And as I came back through the living room to close the front door so I could really do what it is I do when they're not home, I looked in and there was a telephone number across the TV screen that was not on. And it said on there, "If you have a friend with a drinking problem, call this number." And I picked up the phone and I called it. And it was after hours. It rang down in the nurse's station and a lady named Marion, bless her heart, Marion. God, I love her. She answered the phone and she said, "Could I help you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I have a girlfriend with a drinking problem." And she talked to me for an hour, and I had told her, while I was talking to her on the phone, I had picked up the telephone directory, the Yellow Pages, and I was flipping through trying to find out what number went to that treatment center. And I found it, and it said in there, the little Yellow Page ad said 28-day program, women and men, and 40 miles from Birmingham. And I thought, boy, I can go to treatment and nobody here know it. And I talked to her for an hour and even told her if she'd tell me how to get up there that night, I would just drive my car on up there and check in, stay 28 days and come back and go back to living the great American dream. And she said to me, "Shirley, I don't think I would come up here tonight." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, we have snakes." And I said, "Snakes?" And she said, "Well, we're right in the middle of the woods." And she said, "We have a little path that you have to travel when you leave your car at the park at the top of the hill. And we have been known to get people who have gone AMA to come immediately back as soon as they get out after dark and the snakes come out. So why don't you just wait till in the morning?" I said, "I think I will." And so I waited up on Bo and Mike and Sissy, and as soon as Sissy hit the front door, she said, "Mom, you're up." Because, see, the front door was open, the lights were all on, and I wasn't passed out. And it just kind of surprised Sissy because she said, "Oh, Mom, you're up." And I said, "Sissy, I've called the treatment center, and I'm going to do something about my drinking." And she said, "Yes, ma'am." And she went to her bedroom and closed the door. Mike came in, and he said, "Mom, you're up." I said, "Mike, I've called the treatment center, son, and I'm going to do something about my drinking." And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, ma'am." And he went to his room and he closed the door, and one more time he locked it. It was like an ice pick, which told me, "Mom, I don't want you in my bedroom." And then Bo walked in and his remark was, "Oh, you're up." And I said, "Bo, call the treatment center, and I'm going to do something about my drinking. I can't live like this anymore." And he looked at me and he said, "Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different?" And he took a shower and went to bed. It made me so mad because, you see, this was the time I did something. This was the one time that I did something. I made a call. You know, all those other times I begged him to get me out of the mess I was in, or pick up the bad checks, or smooth over the plans for the family that I forgot, and just get me out of this one more time, and I promise I won't drink anymore. And I never did anything about it. But this time I called. I put some action to my promise. And you know, I did go to this treatment center, and I was wanting to stay 28 days, like the little ad said, but I stayed 38 days. And I wanted to stay 45. They wouldn't let me. And they did have something up there called Family Week. Bo called it Hell Week. And I don't remember a lot about it because, you see, I was still in a fog. But I remember three particular things that happened one afternoon in group. I remember sitting in this big old room, and my children were across the room from me looking at me. And the counselor went over to Sissy and said, Sissy, what do you want to do with your mom? And she said, I don't know, but I'm tired of being the mom. I want to be somebody's little girl. I'm 13 years old, and I have to tuck my mother in bed at night, and I'd like for somebody to tuck me in bed. And she said, when I get my hair brushed, I have to walk across the street to Bonnie's house to get my hair brushed. I don't want to be the mother anymore. And I thought, was I that bad? Was I that bad? Yeah. Yeah, I was that bad. Then the counselor walked right over and stood behind Mike. He said, Mike, I want you to tell me, son, what you want to do with your mom. He said, well, I tell you what. He said, I don't want another mother. I just want this one to not drink anymore. I love her, and I don't want another mother. And I thought, well, now he's going to walk over to Bo. And what in the world is Bo going to say? And he walked over, the counselor walked over behind Bo, and he put his arms up on his shoulders. And he said, Bo, I want you to look across the room at Shirley and tell me what you want to do about your wife. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what to do about my wife. He said, I've done everything I know to do to get her to quit drinking. And we're 18 and a half years of marriage that ain't going to make it to number 19. You can have her. And I thought, I only drank in my kitchen. I never got behind the wheel of a car driving. Did I do that much damage? Yes, I did that much damage. Because when I started drinking, I never knew what I was going to do. Well, I stayed the 38 days, and they picked me up on Labor Day weekend of 1982, and we had instructions to go straight to the Bessemer group, which is my home group. My home group is 54 years old, the second oldest group in the state of Alabama. They got kicked off when I was 4 years old, waiting on me. I am 58 years old. Boy, they knew I was coming along, and they got ready for me. And we were told to go to the parking lot of this group, and we were to meet up with a convoy and go to Tuscaloosa and to an anniversary. And my remark was, you mean they have meetings on holidays? And I was told, yes, we have meetings on holidays. So we went to the Tuscaloosa anniversary, and we ran into 500 of y'all, and we fell in love with you. Let me tell you what kept me coming back was the attraction. Because I didn't know what you had. But boy, it was better than what I had. And in 1982, they had a male Al-Anon speaker and a female AA. They have not had that program lineup since. But I couldn't tell you what the Al-Anon's name was, what his name was, or what he said. But let me tell you what happened when the AA lady got up there. She said, hello, my name's Marty, and I'm an alcoholic. And Cece looked at Mike, and Mike punched Bo and said, huh, there's two of them in this world. Her and our mother. And we laughed. We laughed. It was the very first time the Templin family had laughed. And we stayed for the rest of that anniversary, and we got back in the convoy and went back to the Bessemer group. We headed back out to Hueytown, 5 miles to our home, and let me tell you what we did. I had not been home in 38 days. All the drapes were open in that house. The lights were on. Mike went to the kitchen and went to the refrigerator in the kitchen and picked up a gallon of milk. Sissy picked up a 2-pound bag of chocolate chip cookies, and Bo picked up 4 glasses. And we met in the den, and we sat down in the middle of the floor of our home on 28th Avenue. And we sat there and drank milk and ate chocolate chip cookies and talked about you people that night. We didn't know what you had, but whatever it was, we wanted some of it. And when the sun came up on Sunday morning, we all four made a conscious commitment to each other that come heck or high water, we were going to give this program our best shot. And man, what a commitment and what a journey it's been since that day to Macon, Georgia. I tell you what, we asked the kids to go to 4-hour team meetings, and Mike was the one who came to me and said, "Mom, it's not for me." But you see, he was 15, had a motorcycle, was good looking, and had some chasing to do. And I think he did some catching. And that was okay. But he said, "Now I'll go with you. I'll be there for you every night you get one of those little round things." Because they have cake. And he said, "And if you and Dad go to the beach for any reason, I'll go with you. For any kind of a meeting, any kind of an anniversary or a roundup, I'll go with you anywhere to the beach." And he did. But since he fell for Alateen hook, line, and sinker, she had found her home. And it was 2 years before we realized that Sissy's life was saved by Alateen, because she was contemplating suicide the summer that I got sober. And we never knew it. She had told all of her friends at junior high that she wouldn't be there in September, because, you see, she couldn't stand the pain anymore, and because she thought she was the reason her mother drank. Mike had flunked that year. He got his report card in June when I got sober in July, and he had flunked that whole year. But let me tell you why he did. He couldn't study. There was no place in that house that he could study. And so he would get on his motorcycle and leave and come home at 10 o'clock, and the little fella never opened a book. And let me tell you what I did. I blamed myself for a long time for taking away 1 year of my little boy's life. We went home from that anniversary, and on that Tuesday, my children were to start to school. Cece was to go to school and see friends that she had told she would not see. My son had to repeat the grade that he had just done the year before. And the kids were okay. Mike never had a problem with that. He would call me from school at lunchtime, and he would say, "Mom, you ought to see who's sitting next to me in English. I'd have missed it if I'd have gone up the next grade." And he'd come home from school on that motorcycle, and he would say, "I'll tell you what, I'm the smartest one in the class." I love it. I don't have a problem with this, Mom. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. But I still had that feeling that I had taken away 1 year of his life. You see, what happened was, when I would tell Mike that I loved him and put my arms around him, I never looked at him in the eyes anymore. I couldn't look at him in the eyes. I could tell him that I loved him, but there was no eye contact. And so I remember one day he came in from school and they had the announcement about the prom. And he said, "You know, Mom, I've been figuring out on the way home the cost of all this deal." And he said, "By the time I rent a tux and I pay for pictures and flowers and breakfast and golly, gas for the car and all that kind of stuff, Mom, I don't think I can afford to go to the prom." And I said, "Well, what if I pay for it?" He said, "I'll go." And a couple of days before the prom, he came and he said, "I need to ask you a question." And I said, "What?" He said, "Do you know how to dance?" And I said, "Well, I've been known to dance a few steps." And he said, "Well, do you think that when Cece and Dad are not here, you could show me a few steps so that I won't, you know, I'll be able to get out there and hold my own?" And I said, "Sure." So Cece and Bo were gone a couple of hours, and we closed the front door and we turned on the stereo, and I taught him a couple of steps. And he went to the prom and had a ball, danced every dance. Had a ball. And so the next month was graduation, and we had him a little party. He was so excited. Oh, he was just fit to be tied. He was going to Florida for a week, and he already had his plans made there. And he had invited all of his buddies to the party at the house before the graduation. And sometime during the course of a couple of hours, he said, "Mom, I need to see you in my bedroom." And I thought, now he's got all the money he needs to go to Florida, and he's going to hit me up for a loan. You watch. And he'd say, "But I need to talk to you just for a minute, Mom, in my bedroom." And so finally, I said, "Come on, let's go." So as we headed back from the living room toward his bedroom, the front door was open. I noticed 5 cans of beer sitting on the front step. "Oh, dummy," here said, "Mike, what is that on the front step?" And he said, "Mom, it's 5 cans of beer." I said, "But who does it belong to?" And he said, "Well, there are 5 of my buddies that didn't want to miss the party. But I told them we didn't allow alcohol in our home anymore. They'll pick it up when they leave, I promise you. But they just didn't want to miss the party." He said, "By the way, there's one guy here that I told if he didn't behave, you'd take away his car keys." I said, "You didn't." "Yes, ma'am, I did. Told him we didn't allow stuff like that going on around here." So we head on back to his bedroom, and Mike opens up his bedroom door and motions for me to sit down on his bed. And I said, "This must be serious." And he said, "It is, Mom. It's serious to me." He said, "I need to tell you 3 things." And he said, "Then we're going to go to that stadium, and I'm going to get my diploma." So I sat down on the bed, and he said, "Number 1 of the 3 things I want to tell you. Number 1, Mom, I want to thank you for being sober." Wow. He said, "Sissy tells you all the time." And he said, "Every morning when I get up, Mom, I thank God that you've been sober another day. And when I go to bed at night, I thank God for you being sober that day. But," he said, "I need to tell you right now how proud I am of you. And you know, I thought of the promises in the big book, and I thought, they'll never happen to me because I'm junk. I'm junk. And my little boy is telling me that he's proud of me." And I started to get up. And he said, "Mom, I said 3 things." And I said, "Well, I don't know what they could be, but go ahead. You know, I was satisfied with the first one." And he said, "Number 2. He said, "For a long time now, you and I have not been able to look at each other eyeball to eyeball." And I said, "I know, Mike." I said, "You see, when you flunked that year of school, I blamed myself for that because I didn't provide an environment in this house that you could study and feel safe." And I said, "I took away a year of your life." He said, "Mom, you didn't do that." He said, "I flunked myself. You didn't flunk me." And he said, "When you look at me and tell me that you love me, I want you to look at me in the eyes like you used to." And I said, "I don't know if I can do that." He said, "Well, what's going to happen in about an hour is I'm going to get that diploma, which means I'm through with high school. And that glass wall is going to go down. And when you look at me and tell me that you love me in the eyes, there's not going to be any more guilt. Do you understand?" And I thought, boy, he didn't go to many Alateen meetings. But let me tell you, my little boy had a problem. Because you see, when you live in a home where there's active alcoholism, you're affected. When you live in a home where the program is practiced, you're affected. And my little boy didn't go to many Alateen meetings, but let me tell you one. He had a problem. And then he said, "And now let me tell you about number 3. And I looked at him and I said, "Well, I don't know what in the world number 3 could be, but it couldn't possibly be any better than 1 and 2. And he said, "It is. It's the best one of all." And he said, "Number 3, Mom, no matter how many little girls I date, you will always be my number 1 girl." And I got up off that bed, and I walked over to him, and I put my arms around him, and he put his arms around me, and that glass wall went down. And it never came back up. It never came back up. He graduated and went on to Florida for a week, and Mike was fine. The next year, Sissy graduated, and we had this same party. Practically the same people at this party. And the front door was open, and I kept walking by expecting to see some cans of beer, and I never did. And I kept waiting and telling Bo, "Well, she's going to call me in her bedroom in just a few minutes." And he said, "I don't think that's going to happen." And I said, "But it is. You know, Mike did it. I know Sissy is." And she never did. She never did call me into her bedroom. But let me tell you what happened. When I was 7 months sober, she came in from school one day and she said, "I need to talk to you." I said, "Okay." She said, "No, let me rephrase that. My sponsor told me that if I was ever going to get any better in this program, that I had to get all the garbage out. And Mom, I have to sit down with you and I have to tell you all the things that you did to me when you were drunk and in a blackout. All the things you called me and everything you did to me." And I'm thinking, I don't know about this. And she said, "Well, I have it all written down. And I want to get better, Mom. I want to get better." And so we went into her bedroom, and she had this big canopy bed, and we got in the middle of it and sat facing each other, Indian-legged, and she had this big legal pad. My daughter sat there for what seemed to be hours, and she read off all the things that I had done to her and said to her when I was drunk and in a blackout. And when she got through, she folded all the pages back over, and she said, "Mom, that's it. That's every bit of it." And I said, "Sissy, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that I did those things to you." And she said, "Mom, that's all you have to say. You'll never be brought up again. It's never been brought up again." Sissy wanted to go to college, and when she graduated, she told me and her dad, she said, "I've got to go to college." And I said, "Sissy, we don't have the money for college." And I said, "I drank it up." And she said, "But you don't understand. I have to go to college. I've already talked to the professors, and they've told me that all I need is the book knowledge. I have all the on-the-job training." And I said, "What is it that you want to do?" And she said, "I want to be an alcohol and drug counselor. And I want to work with families, and I want to help them get better." And let me tell you, we found a way to take that kid and send her to college. Mike came to me and his dad and said, "I'll help you. For years I've thought I've had the looks and she had the books. We'll do that. We'll send her to school." And Mike had a good job. He didn't care anything about going any further in education. He had a real good job and lived at home, and he was going to live at home till he was 35. And no rent, rent-free. And so we get her carted off to Montevallo, which is 40 miles away, and we get her down there that Sunday afternoon before school, and I get home on Tuesday afternoon, and Sissy's there. And I said, "What are you doing home?" She said, "I don't like it down there without you. It's no fun down there without you." I said, "Young lady, you get up from here right now, and you go back to that school that we've paid for this year. We'll talk about it at the end of the year." And she said, "But, Mom, I need something to help me get through the week." And I said, "Okay, I'll send you a batch of brownies down every Wednesday afternoon by Mike, and that'll help you get through to the weekend." And she said, "Fine." So every Wednesday afternoon, I'd bake this big pan of brownies and wrap them in foil, and Mike would go off to Montevallo to take these brownies, and she would call me and she'd say, "They're still warm." And I tried to pay Mike a couple of times. I said, "You know, I think it's awesome that you want to do this for your sister, but I need to pay you for that mileage that you're traveling in your car." And he said, "Mom, in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have highlighted a sentence that says, 'Be willing to go to any length to get it.' And Mom, I'm checking out all the girls on her dorm floor." Well, it got time for Sissy to move home from school that first year, and Mike once more came to me and his dad, and he said, "I want to move Sissy home." And I said, "Mike, let Dad rent a U-Haul. We'll make one trip because she's going right back in August, and we'll just get it done in one trip." And he said, "But, Mom, you don't understand. I've got four buddies with pickup trucks. We would love to move her home. And all you have to do is fix lunch." And I thought, "Well, now I can do that." So Mike and his four buddies with pickup trucks go down to Montevallo at the end of school. It's Mother's Day weekend, 88. And they move Sissy's stuff home. I mean, she's got a lot of stuff. And they put it right in the living room. Right in the living room, right inside the door. And I said, "Don't you think we need to move some of this out into one of the bedrooms or out on the patio or somewhere? Mike says, well, I got to move it back in August. It'd be easier for me to leave it right here. And that's where it was. And this was Mother's Day weekend of 1988, and we had Mike 1 week. We were planning this vacation to Washington, D.C. on the Amtrak. We already had our tickets. Everything was in line. Because, see, alcoholics don't go on vacation. And we had never been able to afford a vacation. And we'd been in this program almost 5 years and 6 years. And so now we were ready to take a vacation. And we were all busy that first part of the week trying to get packed. And what was to happen was a week later, Mike was killed instantly by a drunk driver. And what happened was his curfew was 10 o'clock. And he didn't make it home at 10. And at 12:30, three policemen knocked on our front door and told us that he had been killed instantly. And I lost it. You know, if something like this was going to happen, why didn't it happen when I was drinking? Why did it have to happen now? And God, you tell me which step I didn't do. God, you tell me how many times I brought home girls and put them in my home, not knowing a thing in the world about them, trying to help them get sober. God, I have to have Mike. You don't understand. He's the little boy that didn't want another mother. He just wanted this one to not drink anymore. The sunshine of my life. I don't remember anything about the 72 hours, except that my sponsor made up a list of 12 hours at a time in shifts of 3 hours. And every 3 hours, there was a different girl right beside me. Their only duty was to keep their eye on me, take me to the ladies' room, wash my face. If I wanted to lay down with me. Give me a cracker with a bit of cheese on it or a little Dixie cup of milk. But stay by me. If I wanted to walk outside and sit on Mike's brand new motorcycle, sit on the motorcycle with me. I want to tell you that I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for those girls at Bessemer. Because you see, my husband was in the bedroom loading the shotgun to go take care of a drunk driver. And it was an AA buddy who went in there and said, Bo, you can't do this. And he said, watch me. Jim said, Bo, you can't do this. Shirley and Cece have to have you. And Jim talked him out of it. You know, I remember that every time I looked around, there was a girl. I remember the morning of the funeral. I was trying to get enough sense about me to know that I had to take a shower to get ready to go to the funeral. And this lady said, come on, we'll go in the bathroom, we'll take a shower. And I said, excuse me? And she said, oh, yes, we're going in the shower together. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you'll let me take a shower by myself, I'll give you $50. I don't know where that came from. And she said, I don't take bribes. And I said, but you don't understand. All I want to do is go in here and take a quick 2-minute shower and get out. And she said, I understand that. We can take a quick two minute shower. And she said, no, can't do that. And I said, well, what's the best option I have? And she said, well, the best deal you've got going is for the bathroom door to be open and me sitting with a chair in the door. And I said, that's it? And she said, that's it, honey, or don't take a shower. So I said, well, I'll take a shower. So I go in there and I turn the water on and I get my towel and my face cloth. And a couple of minutes later, not even that long, I'm hollering and screaming. And she walked in. She said, see, I told you. See, I told you. I had gotten in the shower with all my clothes on. And she said, you can't do anything by yourself. Do you not understand that? I said, I won't say anything anymore. I'll just go along with you. But that's the way I was. I remember at the funeral, Stacy came up to me and she said, "Mom, I want to share something with you." She said, "I used to lay awake in bed at night when you were passed out, and I would say, 'God, let her die in her sleep. Just let her die.'" Or you would take that money out of my piggy bank one more time and you'd get in the car to go buy another bottle of wine, and I'd say, "God, let her forget where we live." But she said, "I'm here to tell you, Mom, that you're going to be okay, because my dad and I will make sure that you get to your meetings. We have to have you." And a week after Mike's death, I heard Bo in the kitchen on the telephone talking to my sponsor, and he said, "I don't know what to do with her. I do not know what to do with her. She's back in her robe that she used to have, and she doesn't cook, and she doesn't eat, and she's not doing anything, and I'm worried about her." And the instructions were to bring me over to her house and drop me off. And Bo came in the den, and he said, "You've got 15 minutes to change clothes." And I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "Over to your sponsor's house." And I said, "I'm not going." He said, "Oh, yes, you are. If I have to pick you up, you do have a choice right now. You can either go change clothes or you can go like you are." And so I thought, well, what the heck. So I went in, I changed clothes, and Bo took me over to Katie's. And when I got there, she came over and she opened the van door and she said, "Come on in, honey, would you like to have a drink?" And I said, "No, ma'am, I don't." And she said, "Come on in, Bo, we'll call you when we're through." We walked into her kitchen, and she had a pot of coffee and a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and a legal pad. And I thought, oh, no, not another legal pad. I can't take another legal pad. And so she said, "Have a seat." And she poured me a cup of coffee, and she passed this legal pad over to me. And she had three numbers, number one, number two, and number three, and a line drawn down the middle, and it said, on one column, "Things I'm grateful for," and on the other one, "Things I'm not grateful for." And she said, "This is real simple, sweetie. I'm going to ask you three questions, and when you get them answered, we'll call Bo, and we'll have Bo come pick you up." And I said, "Is that all I have to do?" She said, "Yeah, that's it." And I said, "Well, what are the questions?" And she said, "Now, be real careful when you answer them." She said, "Number one, Shirley, the night Mike died, was he drinking?" I said, "No, ma'am, he was not drinking. You know he didn't drink." She said, "Put that up underneath the column that you think it needs to go under." She said, "Number two now, Shirley, the night Mike died, was he using drugs?" I said, "No, ma'am, he was not drinking and he was not using drugs." And she said, "Put that under the column you think it needs to go under." She said, "Now I want you to think very carefully before you answer this one, because, honey, you've got to live with this one for the rest of your life." And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Shirley, the night Mike was killed by that drunk driver, was his mother drinking or using drugs?" And I said, "No, ma'am, I was not." She said, "Put that under the column you think it needs to go under." And she said, let me tell you something, Shirley. You're going to be okay. You will never be fine again, honey, but you'll be okay. What you've experienced is you've lost part of your future that you will never get back. I would like to tell you right now this morning that there has never been a time in my sobriety that I wanted to take a drink. Never. But there have been a couple of times along the way when I didn't want to live. And this was one of them. Cece and Bo and I have done the very best that we can do to walk through losing Mike. You never get over something like this. You walk through it the best that you can. And what Cece did was go back to school for Mike. She had three more years of college. She had just started. And she went back to college for Mike. And bless her heart, she went to class enough that they gave her a degree. Yes. She was now ready to go to work and be self-supporting through her own contributions. And When she graduated, she said, "Mom and Dad, can I move back home?" And once more, I went to my sponsor and I said, "What do I do?" She said, "Well, we're going to not have to smother her to death. We can't smother her to death." How do I do that? She said, "Well, she'll let you know when you're smothering her. But love her all you want to. Do whatever you want to for her. Just don't smother her to death." So Cece moved back home and she got a job. And one day she came in from work and she said, "Mom, do you think there's a man out there for me anywhere?" I said, "Sure I do. I think there's a man for every woman and a woman for every man. God's just not through with your man yet." Boy, was I telling the truth. And she said, "But all my girlfriends are getting married, having babies, getting divorced, having babies." And she said, "I'm not doing any of that." And I said, "But your time will come." And so she said, "Okay." So she started the dating scene seriously. And she called me one day at work and she said, "Mom, I have a blind date tonight with a guy named Bob." And I told my boss, I said, "I've got to go home. We've got to find her something to wear. You know, we don't ever have anything to wear." So I went home, and as we were trying to find something, I said, "Now, Cece, I need to tell you a couple of things, honey, when you leave tonight. Now, wait a minute. Don't get in front of me." And she said, "What is that, Mom?" And I said, "Well, when Bob walks you to the door, don't kiss him goodnight." She said, "It might fly for you in 1959, but it ain't going to fly." I said, "Why don't you try it? It just might work." And so anyway, I saw him pull out of the driveway, and once more Bob did open the car door for Cece. I think that was the only time. But anyway, opened the car door for Cece, and they left. And as I heard the car pull back in the driveway, I ran and jumped in bed and pretended to be asleep. And what Cece's pattern was, whenever she would come in from a date, she would come into our bedroom and slide up right between me and her dad and tell us about the evening. And I knew that would happen that night. And so I heard some giggling at the front door, and I heard all the lights flip out and turn off, and then I heard her coming down the hall to our bedroom, and I was just laying there, you know, so excited, and she pulled up right between me and her dad, and she said, "Hey, Mom, is it possible to fall in love on your first date?" I said, "Get up, Bo. We got to make the coffee." And so we got up and we talked, and she giggles about that now, but she says, it worked. And Bob and Cece started dating, and let me tell you, Bob did not come riding into my little girl's life on this big white horse with a big financial statement. Bob comes riding into Cece's life on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with 5 years of good, solid AA sobriety. And Bo and I were okay with that. We were okay with that. They started getting serious, and we talked a wedding, and they wanted to get married in the same church Bo and I married. They said, "If it worked for you, it'd work for us." I said, "I don't think you have to worry about your daddy showing up drunk." And the counselor that we had in Family Week was an ordained minister, and Howard has kept in touch with us the whole time of my sobriety and is a real good friend of the family. And he wanted to come and marry Bob and Cece. So he comes to the church in Hueytown, Alabama, and he's wearing a black Catholic robe doing a Methodist wedding ceremony in a Baptist church. And we think they have a chance. And one of the hardest things at all was Cece said, "Mommy and Dad have to light a candle down front for Mike." And I said, I don't know, Cece. She said, "You and Dad have to walk down the aisle, Mom, together and light a candle for Mike." She said, "Because, Mom, he's only in another room. He's a part of his family." We opened this wedding with a serenity prayer. We closed it with the Lord's Prayer. And Bo got mad at me because we didn't let him pass the basket. Bob's mother came up to me at the reception, and she said, "Can I talk to you just for a moment?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And Bob had come along with two children. At that time, Will was 5 and Kale was 8, and they were both in the wedding. And Frances came up to me and she said, I just need to ask you one question. And I said, what is that? And she said, are you going to take my grandchildren and spoil them rotten? And I said, no, ma'am, I'm not. I'm just going to love them to death. She said, well, if they turn out half as well as Sissy, you will never hear a complaint from me. Awesome. Well, when Bob and Sissy married, all the friends and all the company and everybody started going to Bob and Sissy's house. They never came to Bo and Shirley's anymore. There was no need to. They went to Bob and Sissy's. And so one afternoon after coming in from a conference with the grass needing cut and other things needing done to a big house and a big yard, Bo said, I think we need to sell this big place and kind of move out a little bit and get ready to retire. I said, that's fine with me. Let's call the kids and talk to them. So we had Bob and Sissy over and we told them what we wanted to do, and they both looked at us and said, we don't have a problem with that at all as long as you take us with you. And I knew two families did not need to live together on the same roof. So we moved out to West Blockton, Alabama, and we found us 2 acres, and we put Bo and Shirley a brand new 3-bedroom, 2-bath home at the top of this hill, and 1/3 of the way down we put Bo and Bob and Sissy a new home, 3-bedroom, 2 baths, and it's called Templin Country. Bob's last name is Country. Those who know, know. Those who don't know, it's okay. And life is good. Life is really good. And then one weekend, Bo and I go out of town. Cece had been having these headaches when Mike died, and we all thought that it was a part of the grief process. She just had these horrible headaches where she couldn't even stand a clock radio on. And I found a doctor in Birmingham at a headache clinic, and he said, I can control the headaches, but I can't cure them. And so for the next 10.5 years or so, my little girl was on a regimen of medicine, not habit forming, but medicine, to control the headaches. We were opening Christmas presents 3 Christmases ago when she just kind of startled. And I said, what is it? And she said, I had a pain, like an ice pick. And I said, we need to go have a checkup. And so we went to the doctor, and he ordered an MRI. Long story short, the test results went to a different doctor than the one who ordered them. And Bo and I figured by this time there was nothing wrong with the CAT scan, MRI, so we went out of town for the weekend. And we had just gotten to where we were going when they announced on the loudspeaker, Bo and Shirley Templin, please come to the security office. And first thing I thought of was Sissy. This Sissy, something's happened to Sissy. And so we get on the phone and we find out that the test results have made it to the doctor, and Sissy has an aneurysm sitting on the stem of her brain. And we both lost it one more time. And we get in the van and it's pouring down rain, and the closer we get home, the harder it's raining. My husband's not in a good place. He's not in a good place at all. He's hollering at God and he's saying, God, you've got my little boy. You can't have my little girl. I want all my options. And I don't know what happened. I really can't explain what happened, but it was as if a hand came down on my shoulder and it said, Shirley, honey, you're going to be okay. We'll get through this one more time. And I was okay. I really was okay. And I got Bo to stop the van, and I got behind the wheel and I drove us home. And we had that surgery, and it was textbook perfect. And the hardest part, I think, of all of it was that they had to shave my little girl's head. And that was real traumatic. I went and bought her a hat of every color and of every size and of every shape and everything. And she wore those hats. And she wore those hats while her hair started growing out. And when her hair started growing out, I found a lady in Tuscaloosa who specialized in different haircuts, and like for people who had radiation and chemo. And I took my little girl to this lady, and she made my little girl beautiful again. About 6 weeks ago, I took her back to this same lady, and she got a permanent for the first time. And when the lady got through with her hair, Cece couldn't stand it. She said, I've got to go outside just for a moment. And I thought something was wrong, and I followed her outside, and I said, what is it? And she said, Mother, I'm pretty again. She said, I've been a freak for 2.5 years, and I'm pretty again. And she never was anything but beautiful. But it was real traumatic, and this was hard on all of us. Sissy's okay today. She really is. She's going to be okay, and she's a beautiful young lady. Not too long ago, a friend of mine called in on the spur of the moment, like they usually do, and said, "I need you to come and share." And as I usually do, said yes. And I hung up the phone, and Bo said, "Well, we got to go. Let's get ready and go." And we had to drive to Cullman, Alabama, 60 miles. And so I turned off dinner on the stove, and I turned off my washer and my dryer. And Bo goes to the back of the house and pulls the van around and picks me up. And I get in the van, and I'm just not a very happy camper. I didn't mean to do this. I have things to do. Why should anyone call me in 2 hours' notice and tell me they need me to come and share? Don't they think I have a life? You know, I'm just having a bad time. And we get on the interstate, and it's raining. And twice my husband pulled off the side of the interstate, and he looked at me, and he said, "Honey, you don't have anything to be grateful for, do you?" I said, "No, Bo, I don't. I don't have anything right now to be grateful for." And he said, "Well, I learned a long time ago that my job is to drive you. That's all I do is get you there. And I'm going to get you there. Whatever you and your God do with it is up to you." And so we go to the Cullman group, and it's an old group. It's above a pool hall, and they have the naked light bulbs hanging from the ceilings, and they have couches down the sides where the newcomers sit. And spring's coming up, and I get there, and I run up the steps, and it's 2 minutes till the meeting starts. And I grab me a quick cup of coffee, and I go down, and we open with a serenity prayer. And they call me up there, and I keep looking around the room for Bo, and I'm thinking, this is one time, bless his heart, he's just not going to come in here. I've done it. And sometime during the talk, I see him coming around to the back and finding him a place, and I feel much better. And I get to the part about Mike being killed, and this little fella down on the front row just puts his head down in his lap, and he starts bawling. And I didn't know what to do. I've lost it up here before, but I've never had anybody on the front row. And I looked at Bo, and we had this deal where he'll wink at me or do this if I'm supposed to cut it short. And he winked at me, so I thought, well, I'll go on. And I finished, and we said the Lord's Prayer, and we said amen. And this little young fellow came up and picked me up. He grabbed me, and he hugged me, and he said, "Miss Templin, I'm so glad to see you." I said, "Do I know you?" He said, "Yes, ma'am, you know me." And there were other people standing in line, you know, to hug my neck, and he just kept hanging on to me. He just wouldn't let me go. And he said, I've been in your house. I came to Mike's graduation party. I graduated from school with Mike." And I said, "You had one of the cans of beer." He said, "No, ma'am. I was the one with the car keys." And I said, "What in the world are you doing here, 60 miles from Hueytown?" And he said, "Well, my family's kicked me out, and I'm up here in a halfway house." And he said, "First of all, I want to apologize to you for the way I look." He said, "But I was ticked off because I didn't have company today. So I showed them I didn't go down for lunch. I didn't go down for anything to get a newspaper. I haven't taken a shower. I haven't shaved. I haven't done anything." And I said, "Well, then why did you come to this meeting?" And he said, "Well, there's a rule at the halfway house that the van will not leave unless all the seats are full." He said, "The horn tooted the first time," and I said, "I ain't going." He said, "The horn tooted the second time," and I said to myself, "There ain't no way I'm going." But he said, "By the time it had tooted the third time, I had my tennis shoes in my hand, and I ran out the door." And he said, "I ran up the steps as I saw you sitting down on the front row with your coffee. And I said, it must be meant for me to be here." And I said, "Well, I noticed that you started crying when I was talking about Mike. I said, did you know that Mike had died? And he said, yes, ma'am, but I was too drunk to come to the funeral. And I said, well, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? He said, I never really thought it was that bad. And he said, in fact, 2 weeks after graduation, Mike came up to me in town, and he had a little slip of paper, and he said, here, when you decide you want some help with your drinking, call my mom. And I said, you never have called, have you? He said, no, ma'am, I never thought it was that bad. Well, I would like to tell you that when I got back in the van with my husband that night, I had some amends to make. Because you see, if my husband had turned that van around and taken me back to Hueytown, I would have missed it. I would have missed one more chance of my little boy saying to me, Mom, I'm so proud of you being sober. And I want you to help my friend. And I don't know where he is today. I really don't, because he's never called. God's put four hunks in my life. Four hunks in my life. The first hunk is that guy that I went out with on that blind date and fell in love with instantly. And what we're doing today is we're growing old together, and we're having a ball. We really are. And for once in my life, I'm able to help my husband do something. And he's always taken care of me. For 37 years, he's taken care of me. And now I have a chance to take care of him. Mike is the second hunk in my life. He's up there in heaven, and you know he would have been just as fine a daddy and just as fine a husband, because he was a chip off the old block. Mike would have just been an absolute joy to have children. The third hunk in my life is that young man who came riding into my daughter's life on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he came to Bo and asked Bo for Cece's hand, he said, I can't offer Cece much, but I can love her. I can love him. And he comes along with two precious children who today are 11 years old and 14. And all Will wants to know is what kind of a car I'm going to have when he's 16. And I said, whatever it is, we'll drive it, you know. The fourth hunk in my life is a young man who recorded a song. And the producer of this song, his name was Tom Collins. The first drink I had. And while they were taping this, I'm cutting this record, it took eight cuts. It took eight times of this song before they could get it down pat, because the drummer in this band had a family member dying of cancer, and when they would get to the verse of this song, he would quit playing. And finally, Ronnie Millsap went over and he said, look, kid, we gotta cut this record, and on the eighth cut, it worked. And the verse of this song was Sum Up Shirley Temple. Now I want to close with that verse. What a difference you made in my life. What a difference you made in my life. You're my sunshine day and night. Oh, what a difference you made in my life. And that's my AA. Thank you, and I love you.